All right. Title for this morning. Title for this morning. To fill in or not to fill in? That is the question. On Chol HaMoed. This title or this conversation is sort of a bit overdue.
We have it twice a year.
We have it at least twice a year, and then there's always the spillover, right? Because it's more fun to argue when it's not practical than when it is practical, right? So this is a question, obviously, that comes up on twice a year, both for Pesach and for Sukkot, whenever we have this issue of what we call Chol HaMoed. And as we get into at least some of the first sources here, we'll find, which is sort of obvious, at least in terms of practically what we do, in as much as we know that we do not, and we'll get into why, in as much as we know that we do not lay tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So now we have this question when it comes to Chol HaMoed. And the question and the issue really dovetails with that title, that term. Chol means regular. Chol means not holy. Chol means weekday. Chol means not sanctified. Chol means secular. HaMoed of the holiday means the holiday, a meeting point between God and the Jewish people. It means holiness, it means sanctity, it means festival. So what do? We don't put on tefillin on the actual moed, on the actual holiday, the same way that we don't on Shabbos. We'll get into why in a minute. What happens during this Chol HaMoed? What's the emphasis on? Is this more of a regular weekday? Or is this more of a holiday? And we're not really going to get the question. Just sort of is left there, and we find that there's something of a division amongst different groups, different authorities. And we're not going to delve into that as much as, practically speaking, after the fact. So we have these different schools of thought as to whether to put tefillin on or not. How do you then deal with that, and how do we address it? And as we were just discussing just a minute ago, this has become an issue that rises to the surface even more in the United States of America or in Israel, really not so much the geographical location as much as this period of time. Right, once upon a time, you had, and this is not entirely true, as we'll see in some of the source material, but by and large, once upon a time, in shtetl, in everyone in Anatevka puts on tefillin, or no one in Anatevka puts on tefillin. Very easy. What do you do when you have three people from Anatevka, and then you have two people from Huss and Fluss, and then you have a couple of other families from Yehupitz, and they all end up davening in the same shtiebel in Chicago? So now what do? How do you set policy? How do you make a determination? And is it so simple to just allow everyone to do as they would like based on their particular family and or previous communal custom? Or do we need to set one policy that sort of suffices for everyone? That's what we're really going to get into, right? When Laser Wolf and Tevye are parting ways, so they see one another across the yard when all the Jews are being kicked out of Anatevka, and Laser Wolf yells at them, "Where are you heading? New York, America. How about you? Chicago, America. Great, we'll be neighbors." So with this dispersion of Jews into different locales and different cities, we find that we have collections of different people who had originally come from different towns in Eastern Europe, different places throughout the Mideast, and very often, less so in our particular shul, when I was in Holliswood, it was very much the case that you had even Sephardim and Ashkenazim davening side by side. Right, so how do you make a determination about to yes or to not lay tefillin on Chol HaMoed? So let's get into some of the background here. The first issue that we need to concern ourselves with in regards to the issue, before we even get into tefillin. In general, we'll get there. The general issue of divisiveness in the Jewish people. On the one hand, We sort of wear that as a badge of pride, don't we? Right? That we're so diverse, and then we're always yelling and arguing at each other. On the one hand, it's sort of a point of embarrassment. On the other hand, it sort of speaks of the Jewish nature, right? It's that inherent Jewish chutzpah that we don't mind arguing with one another. On the other hand, of course, we're always seeking shalom. We're always seeking the ability to get along with one another. Here we have a pasuk, and this is a really unusual pasuk in terms of the way that it's taken for practical halacha. An interesting verse. This comes in Deuteronomy and Sefer Devarim in Parshas Re'eh. So, Moses reminds everyone what beautiful words before they enter the land of Israel, right, coming from their leader, coming from like the parent figure. It's really interesting that remember that the whole of Deuteronomy is Moses saying goodbye. And this leader that they have very, very much clung to, so much so that when that leader disappears, they feel that they've lost all connection even to God. And now, listen to what Moses reminds them about. You are children to Hashem, your God. That in and of itself warrants study. Not only that you should realize just how holy you are, but remember that even as I disappear, I am in the great scheme of Judaism not as important as you might think that I am. Because even after I disappear, remember that you're still children to Hashem, your God. And every child has an innate ability to connect to his own father, at least when that father is willing. And believe me, Moses tells them, he's willing. So you are children to Hashem, your God. What does that then mean? Therefore, ergo, you shall not cut yourselves, and you shall not make a bald spot between your eyes for a dead person. Idolatrous practices, things that were done in order to commemorate or in order to take note of the passing of a loved one, that there would be this self-inflicted cutting and wounding of oneself, shaving one's head, etc. Don't abide by those practices. Remember that you're different. Remember that we have a different way. Inasmuch as you are children of Hashem, your God, as much as we say that this applies to every human being, you very much need to remember that you are created B'Tselem Elokim in the image of God. Your physical image and your physical body is not to be tampered with, right? Don't cut yourself. Don't give in to this self-infliction, even when it comes to something as important as taking note of the loss of a loved one. Apparently, this was fairly common practice. Moses tells them not to do it. After all, you are children to Hashem, your God. Now, the actual Hebrew terminology that's used here is very important. We say, lo titgodedu, or lo sisgodedu, depending on, again, we're trying to make peace. Whatever pronunciation you prefer. Los is go to do. You shall not cut yourselves. The idea of creating a gedida is creating a division, creating a line that separates flesh from flesh, essentially. What's very interesting about this pasuk is that as far as halachic purposes go, we take this on two levels, both in terms of the way that we plainly understand it. We're speaking about cutting oneself following the death of a loved one. But furthermore, we take that notion of gedida, of creating a division. Take a look at the Gemara in Yevamos. It's the next source. You shall not cut yourselves. What does that mean? You shall not divide yourselves into factions. We take this to mean not only in terms of the individual and his or her physical flesh, but also as a nation and as what is meant to be an organic unit, do not divide yourselves into different factions. Now, we need to understand that, by the way. The first thing we need to understand is that this exists in light of the fact that the Jewish people were already very clearly divided into 12 different tribes, right? So we know that right off the bat. What this does not mean is that there is only one particular way. There is only one approach, but we have to sort of understand this in the context of if we already have 12 different tribes and we already have distinctions between Kohanim, Levium, and Israelites, so what does it then mean to further divide yourself into factions? Because that apparently becomes a biblical prohibition. So what does it mean? We have a dispute, obviously, between Abaye and Rava, two of the giants. Abaye said, when do we apply you shall not divide yourselves? What does losis go to do mean practically? For instance, when there are two rabbinical courts in one city, these instruct in accordance with Beis Shammai, and these instruct in accordance with Beis Hillel. Big problem. You can't have two courts in the same city who are instructing the populace to act according to two different schools of thought. They got to get their acts together so that there is one unified approach of instruction, of rendering halachic legal decisions.
We do mostly go by Hillel.
Yeah. It's an example, right? Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, in addition to being two actual yeshivas, they sort of represent, it becomes a paradigm for two different approaches and two different schools of thought. But when it comes to two courts in two different cities, there's no concern. So, hence, if I'm living in Zevulun, and you're living in Yehuda, if you're living in Binyamin, and I'm living in Shimon, so then you can say potato, and I can say patata. If we're living in two different tribes or two different cities, however we subdivide the Jewish nation, then there is no concern that what is being done in New York is not being done in Jerusalem. There's no concern that what's being done in Tunis is not being done in Berlin. No problem. Or even Berlin to Frankfurt. I mean, you can get as close as you like. Minsk and Pinsk. No concern. Rava says to him, but Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel themselves are like two rabbinical courts in one city. What are you talking about? You said that you can't have two rabbinical courts in one city. This one goes like Beis Hillel and this one goes like Beis Shammai. What about Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai? You're saying that what they did was incorrect, was inappropriate. We basically hallow their opinions in the Mishnah and then in the Gemara. And we put them up on a pedestal and say, beautiful, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai. We happen to, generally speaking, as Marv said, we generally speaking go according to Beis Hillel. But Beis Shammai was wrong for arguing with Beis Hillel. Beis Hillel was wrong for arguing with Beis Shammai. Nothing wrong with having two yeshivas that operate on two different wavelengths. Nothing wrong. So rather, Rava said, what are you talking about? What do we mean here when we say don't create a division? Don't create divisiveness. Don't create factions. When do we apply losis go to do you shall not divide yourselves into factions? For instance, when there is one rabbinical court in the city, and some of its members instruct according to Beis Shammai, and some instruct according to Beis Hillel. Now you got a problem. We're all part of the same rabbinical court. We're all within the same yeshiva. And this Rosh Yeshiva says that, yeah, that Rosh Yeshiva is an ignoramus. Don't listen to him. And this Rosh Yeshiva says that, your Rosh Yeshiva doesn't know what he's talking about. And this Dayan, this judge says, don't listen to them. They don't know what they're doing. And this Dayan, back and forth. That creates major, major divisiveness. Like the Supreme Court, for instance, right? By the way, the way that now this is going to happen internally, right? Internally, the reason why, especially as the cases get more and more difficult, we look for more and more judges because we want more and more opinions. And if they can actually come to consensus amongst all these different opinions, then that's really saying something. We always have an odd number because it is to be assumed that they'll disagree with one another. So the only way to have majority rule, let's say in a simple Beit Din, you have three people, because we expect that one will argue with the two. What that means, though, is that that conversation is meant to take place back in the judge's chambers. That's not meant to take place out in public, and it certainly should not get to the point and escalate to the point where the judges are actually publicly instructing, you do this and you do that. They're supposed to have enough mutual respect for one another that they say, if it's two against one, then I'll back down, and that's the ruling. I'm entitled to my opinion, but that doesn't necessarily mean practically that I have the right to instruct others. What that then means as far as these individual schools and individual tribes is beautiful. There is a certain amount of deviation or distinction that we will tolerate and embrace, not just tolerate, embrace and be very happy about and receive very warmly. We embrace the notion of diversity even within the Jewish people. What gets very hairy is when you have one court that's meant to give one unified sort of front. You understand how this could totally tear a community apart, right? That one says one thing and the two said, don't listen to them. They don't know what they're doing. They'll listen to him. He's an Amaretz. We're gonna you know, fire him anyway. Right, exactly. Yeah, questions? Camille, did you have?
Yeah, so when you go to a yeshiva, are you required to accept the verdicts of the head of the yeshiva?
Interesting question. In general, yes. Okay. Yes. The reason why I'm hesitant is because the yeshiva has really developed into a place where more than you know, the Rosh Yeshiva as a personality, and I mean as that role, is different from the communal rabbi, and is different from the halachic authority generally, in that it is more a house of study than a house of, you know, verdict and psak. Having said that, yes, when there is a stance that the yeshiva takes, you're expected to toe the line. This came up, by the way, when I was in Mivaseret. Mivaseret is a beautiful little suburb, either on the outskirts of Jerusalem or just beyond Jerusalem, depending on who you ask. So our Rosh Yeshiva, the American Rosh Yeshiva, believed that we were not really part of Jerusalem. We shared a campus with an Israeli kollel. And the Rosh Kollel, the head of the kollel of the Israelis, believed that we were on the very outskirts of Jerusalem. So what did this make a difference for? Purim. Do you celebrate Purim or Shushan Purim? Aha! When do you read the Megillah? More importantly, when do you get drunk? So we were very machmir, we were very strict, and we got drunk both days and sometimes even the day before and the day afterwards just to play it safe. And the Shabbos before. Welcome to yeshiva. No. So it really did make a difference. When do you have a seuda? When do you have to give shalach manos? When do you have the miyat? All these issues become very relevant. Most importantly, right, is when do you read the Megillah? So this became a bit contentious. So we actually did, our Rosh Yeshiva told us that we should be machmir, right, that we should be strict and also abide by the ruling of the head of the Israeli kollel. But what we had to do was do the American version, right, say that we weren't part of Jerusalem, meaning that we're reading on the 14th, we have to do that in privacy. And initially it was done a little bit more publicly. I remember my first year we would do it in our own personal cheder ochel, the dining room, do it on our own, no Israelis, but it got to the point where the Israeli Rosh Kollel really objected, saying that, like, everybody knows that it's happening. It's just not appropriate. So we started doing we did yet more private readings, like in the dormitories and things like that, which is really the way that it ought to be done. It's very meaning if you have a particular ruling, and in this particular situation where you have, you know, you're in Israel, it's the Israeli authority, you have a kollel and a yeshiva that are sort of sharing ground, it became really a very appropriate way of dealing with that issue. So that's the issue that we have. Two rabbinical courts in one city might be one thing, but what happens when you start to view this as perhaps one rabbinical court, right? One yeshiva, one campus, two yeshivas, but it's one campus. You know, how do you address those sorts of things? This is where we need to be really, really careful. Rashi on the Gemara, right? Rashi did not only comment on the Bible, Rashi also commented on the Talmud in its entirety. So Rashi explains, what's the issue here? When we say, losis godadu in the pasuk, in the verse in the Bible. So the Gemara, the Talmud, tells us that what we mean by losis godadu, do not make divisions, is losasu agudos agudos, do not create multiple factions, do not divide yourselves into factions. Rashi explains, what's the issue here? He says, the nir ek kenohagin beis toros, because it makes it appear as though there are two toros, two Torahs. We're acting according to two Torahs. So again, there's a balance here. We embrace, not divisiveness, but we embrace diversity. We embrace different flavors when the different flavors are, listen, in Judah they do X, and in Benjamin they do Y, and in Tunis they do X, and in Berlin they do Y, and in Pinsk they do Aleph, and in Minsk they do Beis. Fine. But when we're all within one city, and we have one body of rabbinic authorities that we turn to, and they can't get their act together, that's when things get really, really divisive. And indeed, throughout Jewish history, that's what we found. We can tolerate and embrace the notion that there are distinctions between Sephardim and Ashkenazim. We can embrace the fact that there are distinctions between tribe A and tribe B. What gets hairy, and this has happened, is when you have within one city, one body of rabbinic authorities that begin to deviate and then publicly instruct against one another. So, how does this play into our precise issue? This is in general. It's a very important umbrella issue, this idea of lo tidgodadu, do not divide yourselves into factions, when we do apply that, when we don't apply that. How does that apply then to our actual issue? So if we take a look at the Shulchan Aruch first, so Rav Yosef Karo, he is the Sephardic rabbi, and he says as follows. This is in Simon Lamed Aleph. This is number 31, Orach Chaim, the Laws of Daily Living. So in the first article he says, B'Shabbos v'Yom Tov, Aser l'haniach tefillin. It is forbidden to wear tefillin, to lay tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Why? Mipnei shehem atzmam os. They themselves are a sign. V'im manichim bahem os acher, and if we would then place another sign, haya zilzul os shalahem, this would serve as a degradation of the sign of Shabbos and Yom Tov. What is he talking about? So we're more familiar with this than you realize. Once I remind you of the actual quotes from the Bible, from the Chumash, we speak of tefillin as being an os, right? That they should be a sign on your arm and on your head. And think about what we said. We say it in Shemona Esrei, actually, that Shabbos is Beinu veinechem oshi leolam, between me and them, this is an eternal sign of my covenant. The idea that we refer to Shabbos and Yom Tov in of themselves as being a sign, right? That that's how we refer to them in the Torah. We say that they are a sign, they are an indication of the covenant that exists between me and the Jewish people. Tefillin are also meant to act in that way. It's certainly different. Right. Also bear in mind that when the Torah is first given, they're wearing tefillin all day long. Right? They're only taken off at night and when you go to the bathroom. Today we only put them on for shacharis and then take them off. But once upon a time, they were worn all day long. The Talmud is replete with all of these questions about what do you do with your tefillin when you're on the road and then you go to the bathroom. Like, what are you talking about? It's packed in your carry-on. Like, what do you mean, what do you do with it? No, because they were wearing it. They were wearing it, and by the way, they didn't have those little plastic cases because they didn't have plastic. So what do you do with it? How do you take off your tefillin on the one hand and do what you need to do at the rest stop on the side of the road, and yet on the other hand treat the tefillin with dignity and respect? What are you supposed to do with the tefillin when you go to sleep at night? Is it appropriate to put them under your pillow? How do you care for them? How do you ensure that they stay safe, but also not wear them while we're sleeping and while we're doing other things, at which time it would be inappropriate to wear the tefillin? So all these kinds of issues. When you think of to your average Greek or Assyrian or Babylonian or Canaanite, the image of the Jew was this guy with a beard, maybe with payas, but a guy with a beard and a full head covering, wearing tefillin and in a talis all day long, right? Walking around like a superhero with a cape. Pretty cool. So it becomes even more relevant if you think about it in those terms, but the notion of tefillin is that they are referred to in the Torah as a sign. So now we get into this issue, and we understood through the Talmud. The Talmud understands that if they are both referred to as a sign, that means that one is sort of supposed to trump the other. To also wear tefillin, well, why not? You know, the more the merrier. No, because if Shabbos is really meant to be a sign, and Yom Tov is really meant to be a sign, the way in which we live on those days, the way in which we carry ourselves on those days, to suggest that we need something in addition as a physical article, as a physical ritualistic religious item that is placed on our heads and on our arms to broadcast that we are members of the covenant of God, then one sort of detracts from the other. So basically, on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we don't wear these things. So, Chol HaMoed. What do you do about Chol HaMoed now? Yemar.
There was a time when they wore tefillin all day long. What about somebody, I don't know, that sold fish or something, or dug something or ground all day long? How can you give the tefillin honor by handling fish with your
hands? So we see from this that you're not allowed to sell fish.
Pardon me?
No, I'm joking. There are going to be certain activities. This is like, how do you know that Yaakov Avinu, that Jacob, how do you know that he wore a hat? How do you know that he wore a hat all day long, right? Even when he went outside? Because it says, Vayetze Yaakov. Yaakov went out. You think he went outside without wearing a hat? It's kind of... So you see, you're not allowed to sell fish. So obviously, they're going to be, if you're totally schwitzing out in the field, right, and there are going to be certain times when it's not necessarily going to be appropriate to wear tefillin, right? You come back in from the field and you have black paint, dripping all day, and your tefillin are totally, misformed. But the point is that the default setting is that we wear tefillin, not that we don't wear tefillin. Today, the default setting is that we don't. We put them on. We make a special point of putting them on for a prayer service and then take them off. Once upon a time, the default setting was that we wear them. And if you were involved in some sort of activity where it was inappropriate or it was dangerous or it was, you know, is going to start to detract from the honor of the tefillin, the glory of the tefillin, then they'd be removed. Did you have a question?
I don't have it. There's a story of a man wearing tefillin while he was greasing the axle of his wagon.
Mm-hmm.
So he wore tefillin, he was still wearing tefillin.
May be certain activities, even so, for your profession where it would be taken off. But it's very difficult for us to gauge what is and what is not appropriate, considering that it's something that in general we don't wear. Certainly the impression that we get from the Gemara is that the default setting is you are wearing them. You're traveling, you're on a horse, you're wearing tefillin. You're wearing a talus. Very, very different. Or whether it was a talus, the way that we wear them, some sort of, you know, four-cornered garment that was, you know, wrapped around you that had tzitzis on it. Okay. Number two. So now we get into Article 2. Here comes the question. On Chol HaMoed, it is likewise prohibited to wear tefillin for the same reason. This is Rav Karo speaking. This is the Sephardic rabbi living in Tzfat. For the days of Chol HaMoed are also a sign. When we say that a moed is a sign, we mean that the moed, the holiday, from start to finish. That means, remember, he was living in Israel. So that means 7 days of Pesach, and that means 7 days of Sukkot. And then also, obviously, on Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day following Sukkot. Right? All 7 days of the holiday, including Chol HaMoed, are going to be considered a sign. Now, the Ramah says, but others say that on Chol HaMoed one is obligated to wear tefillin. Okay, so a very typical sort of dispute between the Ashkenazic authority, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, the chief rabbi of Krakow, and Rav Yosef Karo, the chief Sephardic rabbi living in Tzfat. And such is the practice in all these regions. So he says, out here in Eastern Europe, this is what we're doing. We're all wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed, Ashkenazim are. To wear them on the holiday... and such is the practice in all these regions, to wear them on the holiday and to recite the blessing upon them. Wow, pretty intense. But we do not recite the blessing aloud in the synagogue as we do during the other days of the year. Episa distinction. Some sort of differentiation between what happens during the year and what happens on Chol HaMoed to show that it's not exactly the same. He doesn't speak about when we take them off, but it seems that the general practice, and whether this was the case in the time of the Ramah or not, but today, general practice is that for those who are wearing tefillin, we remove them before Hallel, which is different from Rosh Chodesh, for instance. On Rosh Chodesh, we remove the tefillin for Musaf. So we tend to remove the tefillin when it comes to a point in the service at which we say, this is really holiday-esque. So for Rosh Chodesh, really, we're supposed to wear tefillin on Rosh Chodesh. There's no argument against that. We even recite the blessing, absolutely and unequivocally. But we remove them for Musa. So on Chol HaMoed, those who wear tefillin, we take them off for Hallel, because Hallel, after all, is an expression of the fact that this is a Moed, not only Chol. So let's take them off for Hallel. I would say that common practice now, and I didn't quote it, but the Mishnah Berurah actually said, did I quote it? We did. Okay, let's go to the Mishnah Berurah next. Now, Mishnah Berurah. So the Mishnah Berurah is far more contemporary. We're talking about a 19th and 20th century authority, right? Chief Rabbi of Radin. The Chafetz Chaim wrote the Mishnah Berurah. And Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan wrote the Chafetz Chaim. We're following, right? So Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan wrote, first book that he wrote was the Chafetz Chaim. It was so popular and such an impressive work that he became known as the Chafetz Chaim. And he then later authored the Mishnah Berurah as well, which is a commentary on these sections of the Shulchan Aruch. So he says that the later authorities wrote further that it is not appropriate within one synagogue for some to wear tefillin and for some to not wear tefillin because of lo sis go to do. You shall not divide yourselves into factions. All within one synagogue even going according to the opinion of Rava, where he says that the issue is within one rabbinical court. You have two rabbinical courts in one city? Fine. One rabbinical court, you can't have some instructing one way and some being instructed another way. So that's essentially what you have when you have one synagogue. How do you have within one synagogue some acting this way and some acting that way? Let's just finish, and then we'll finish this source, Phyllis, and then we'll take your question. And one who does not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, who is praying in a synagogue in which they wear tefillin, should also wear them without reciting a blessing. Fake it. Fake it for the sake of peace and harmony. And a congregation that has the practice of wearing tefillin should not change their custom. Okay, so we don't feel that we need to have one sweeping custom that applies to each and every synagogue. What we are saying, says the Mishnah Berura, is that if you approach, if you find yourself davening in one of these shuls that operates according to a different custom on Chol HaMoed, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Sort of. When in Minsk, do as the Minskalach do. When in Pinsk, do as the Pinskalach do. Follow according to whatever custom is prevalent, whatever the adopted custom is, in the shul in which you are davening. Yeah, Phyllis.
So then Charles was wrong, because he said his Malach said, do whatever your family is accustomed to. And so he said during Chol HaMoed of Passover, some people had to fill it out and some didn't. And so he came and he said, well, I don't usually ever do it before, so I won't. And so he did it.
So there are two issues here. The first issue is that I will never argue with a Jewish woman saying that her husband is right. So you're right. He's wrong. All that I would mention and bring up is that there are some additional sources that we still need to get to.
So let me ask you something. Would it be, should there then be some kind of a note or something that goes up that says,
so what this is sort of in defense of is that at least the stance that I've taken in the past couple of years is do whatever you feel like, right? Which is what the Luach says. Do whatever you feel like. So let's keep going. Okay, your trigger head. You want to get to the end? Okay, I got it. We're getting there. No. It's fine. So now, to be fair, the Mishnah Berura is pretty authoritative. Pretty authoritative, and yet we find that doesn't seem to be the practice, right? Generally speaking, see, we have distinctions. We have some shuls where they say this is the practice, and when we say this is the practice, then either find someplace else to daven or whatever. That's really, really unusual. More common, and I would say especially more common in America, is that we have a shul that might say either one of two things. Either this is our custom, and if you have a different custom, so then we would just ask you to daven on the other side of the mechitza, which is really fairly common. That's what we actually used to do in my yeshiva. The custom of the actual base medrash was don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. If you wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, so go to the women's sections. We had two balconies. And then once you take them off, then, you know, come back down. So that you were still part of the minyan, but you weren't making a public display of acting out of consonance with the accepted custom of the yeshiva.
So you daven with the women?
No, there are no women there on a weekday morning. Yeah, 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 yeah. Right. Good question. Great question. We actually had two balconies anyway, so in theory, you know, we could have all shifted.
Wouldn't the clergy set the rule usually, not the congregation? With the clergy, especially the rabbi, wouldn't he more or less set the rule for that?
Oh, from your mouth to God's ears, Bubby. Yeah, right. Wouldn't the rabbi usually set the policy, not the congregation? Yeah, halavai. No, you're right. Of course, you're right. Having said that, the question is, what's the appropriate policy to adopt? And once that policy has been adopted, what happens with passersby? Right. We get a lot of passersby here. And then even more so if you're in a place like Queens, Brooklyn, where you have so many shuls around and so many different people who have so many different family customs. Today I daven here, tomorrow I daven there, the next day I wake up a little later, I wake up a little earlier, I'm going to work, I'm not going to work, and all of that. So what do you do? How do you react to that? Yeah, Lou. I would assume he wore tefillin.
With or without a bra?
So I was actually surprised that I never realized, actually, that the Ramah actually says to make the bracha. I don't believe that's prevalent custom. I don't know what Ramesha did. I would assume that he certainly wore tefillin. He was very much a Litvisha Yid. I don't know bracha or not. Really?
Yeah.
Rabbeinu Tam is the other... the other way of tefillin. There's a dispute very, very quickly. Very quickly. There's a dispute between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi, we know, is Rashi, and Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's grandson. So there was a dispute between the two, probably not in person, but in terms of their writings, that Rashi believed that the order of the parchment, the order of the parshiot, written on the parchment should go in one particular order. Rabbeinu Tam thought that it should go in a different order. So then we have what we call today Rashi Tefillin and Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. Anybody who wears one pair of Tefillin is wearing Rashi Tefillin, right? Which is true of most Ashkenazic non-Hasidic Jews. Hasidim tend to wear both pairs of tefillin. The Shulchan Aruch speaks about wearing two pairs of tefillin. Some Sfardim do. I think most Sfardim do not. But Hasidim do wear both pairs of tefillin to ensure that you get it right. As a general rule, we say we follow Rashi, and that's, you know, sort of case closed. But anyway, that's a little sidebar. Yeah.
Because
Lubavitcher Rebbe suggested that he should.
Lubavitcher Rebbe sent him a pair of Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, and just out of respect.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, if Lubavitcher Rebbe sent me a pair of Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, I'd put them on. Yeah. Yeah. I guess Rav Moshe felt the same way, right? Okay, fair enough. Interesting. I'd never heard that. Now, we get into some other. So the question is, what exactly do we do? What's the appropriate stance to take? What's interesting is that this notion of, let's say, davening in a different part of the shul doesn't seem to jive according to the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah says, no, if you are in a shul in which the established custom is X, then you have to adopt X. Fake it. Just fake it for the sake of what we call losis godedu. Right, we have a biblical prohibition against dividing ourselves into factions. Certainly, according to the Mishnah Berurah, within one prayer space, which is akin to one rabbinical court. So now we have a couple of other opinions. These are lesser known, but still very, very important authorities. They haven't gotten the publicity that they likely deserve. But one we'll take a look at is the responsa of Maharshag, which was Rav Shimon Greenfeld. And the next is going to be the Parshas Mordechai, which was Rav Mordechai Bennett. Okay, very interesting responsa from both of these European authorities. So let's go to the Maharshag. Arachayim, Chelek Beis, Volume 2, Article 12, Simin Yud Beis. Okay. In response, it would seem to me that this prohibition of you shall not divide yourselves, losis godedu, was only stated in regards to one who instructs others to act in a particular way. Meaning, think about what Rava is saying. Rava says that you can't have two judges, two authorities on one rabbinic court panel, one saying publicly instructing everyone according to one approach and one instructing everyone according to another approach. That is, if there were to be one rabbinical court in the city, and one judge from that court were to instruct the public to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, and a second judge from that same court would instruct the public to not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, now you got a problem. That is what we call losis godedu. For two rabbis of the same rabbinical court to get up and say, this is what you absolutely should do, and then the other one says, that is absolutely not true, and this is what you should do. That is what we call losis godedu. In such instances, the prohibition of you shall not divide yourselves, stated in the Talmud in Yevamos, page 13, would be relevant. And so it is it evident from the language the Talmud uses in its conclusion, for it is stated there in these terms. Rather, Rava said, we say that the prohibition of not dividing yourselves, of losis godedu, when does that apply? In an instance in which there is one rabbinical court in the city, some of whose members instruct according to Beis Shammai, and some of whose members instruct according to Beis Hillel, but two courts in one city pose no concern. Why does the Talmud not give us an example of two men in one city, two laymen? One practicing according to Beis Shammai and one practicing according to Beis Hillel. So the example that we're given is that the issue becomes one of instruction. Losis godedu is something that the rabbis need to worry about. Losis godedu is something that the judges need to worry about. Losis godedu is something that the Beis Din as a unit needs to be concerned with, realizing the fallout of one member of each standing up and delivering a psak, delivering a halachic ruling that is out of consonance with the party line. We have to get together and decide what we're going to say, even if we're going to be overly liberal and say, do whatever you want. But losis godedu means that one rabbi and then another rabbi get up from the same rabbinical court and instruct by saying that you should do A, no, wrong, you should do B. That becomes problematic. What we have here is very different. What we have here is laymen practicing for themselves based upon some previous custom that had already been developed and accepted by their family, by their community going back to Europe or the Middle East or wherever. Rather, it is certainly evident to me from this that for laymen to practice for themselves without instructing others. I'm not telling you, you want to wear no tefillin, you want to wear tefillin, Rashi tefillin, Rabbeinu Tam, do whatever you want, leave me alone, I'm in the middle of my Shemona Esrei, I shouldn't even be talking to you. Rather, it is certainly evident to me from this that for laymen to practice for themselves without instructing others, this prohibition was never stated whatsoever. For each one is entitled to act according to the clarity of his own understanding and the ways of the Torah and the ways of serving Hashem, which might be predicated on family custom, which might be predicated on I'm also a Talmud Chacham and I also learned all the sources and this was what seems to me. I'm not telling you how to do it. Do whatever your Rebbe tells you. Do whatever your Rabbi tells you. Do whatever your father tells you. I'm not telling you how to do it. Losis Godedu applies only to rabbinic authorities. There needs to be a sensitivity that your words carry a lot of weight, and if you give two opinions that are divisive, you'll create divisiveness within the community. That's the issue of Losis Godedu. Another approach, similar but different. This comes from, again, the Parshas Mordechai, which was Rav Mordechai Bennett. Here's what he says. In regards to the wearing of tefillin, it has already developed as the custom in many places that within one city there are two synagogues, for Sfardim and Ashkenazim. He gives as an example, such as in the holy community of Amsterdam and other such places. These follow their customs and these follow their customs. Beautiful. So we embrace a certain amount of diversity. Perhaps. Because now in the backdrop he has, but what about Rava? And what about Rava's approach to Losis Godedu? Is this perhaps an issue? So he says, one's forced to answer that according to Rava, the prohibition only exists at the onset of the dispute in one rabbinical court. It's a slightly different approach. It's not that it only applies to the rabbis. It might also apply to the laymen. But the idea is perpetuating what has become a divisive issue. Yes, even for the laymen, but it's to perpetuate what first began as a divisive issue. If it never began as a divisive issue, because by me in Pinsk, we always wore tefillin. By me in Minsk, we never wore tefillin. Okay, so fine. I don't recall, you know, the rabbis of Pinsk and Minsk ever yelling and screaming at each other. This one gave a ruling for his city. This one gave a ruling for his city. What we have today is this crazy situation. And we see that it's not only today. Right? It's not only in America and in Israel. This happened with people traveling in different areas even much, much earlier. But certainly today, you happen to have somebody whose Zayda lived in Minsk, and the other guy, Huzeda, lived in Pinsk, and they're all davening in the same shtiebel and flatbush together. So now what do we do? So we do, assuming, right now, you get into a different question, if that particular shtiebel, that particular shul, has its own custom, but at least conceptually, it would not be considered divisiveness. It wouldn't be considered to be an infraction of Losis Godedu for each to practice according to what's already become a very established custom. The distinction here, though, is that indeed it would apply to laymen, at least conceptually. For laymen to get involved in the brawl and the dispute and to start taking sides, that is going to create an even greater, it's going to just stoke the flames even more so. Okay? So two different approaches. Does it apply to laymen, yes or no? Either way, it seems that we have some ground to say that today it wouldn't really make a difference. If it only applies to the authorities, I'm not telling you what to do. I just want to do what my family has always done. And even if it applies to laymen, at the onset of the issue, I'm just following what was already accepted for generations. I'm not starting a new issue now. I'm not trying to fan the flames and rekindle the flames of an old argument. It's already happened. Okay. So what we get into now is what exactly is the issue here, right? It doesn't seem that this particular approach of the Mishnah Berurah has ever really followed, right? The idea that we should take this notion of Losis Godedu and apply it to the idea of wearing tefillin as the Mishnah Berurah does, which would mean, I don't care if you've never worn tefillin in your life on Chol Hamoed, you're davening here, put on the tefillin. That doesn't seem to be accepted, which means that we are, in fact, leaning upon whether it's these particular authorities or this general school of thought that for whatever reason, Losis Godedu doesn't really apply here. So if it doesn't really apply, where do we get this notion of perhaps davening behind the mechitza, right? huddling in the corner or like davening right outside, so that we don't publicly demonstrate that I'm doing something different. Where does that come from? What we need to be aware of is that there is another concept here, which isn't quite as forceful or as strong as losis godedu, dividing yourselves into different factions, a real biblical prohibition. But we do have another just umbrella concept of trying to be as harmonious as possible. We have in the first mishnah, in the fourth chapter of Pesachim, right? Pesachim deals with Pesach and other related items. In a place in which they are accustomed to do work on the eve of Passover until midday, so shall they do. In a place in which they are accustomed to refrain from work, so shall they do. There is an idea of not performing acts of labor, at least with the exception of that which is necessary to prepare for the holiday, on even Erev Pesach, to sort of treat it as like a quasi Yom Tov in of itself. After all, it's the day when the Karban Pesach was actually slaughtered. It was eaten the next day, but it was sort of a quasi holiday. Remember that in the times of the temple, nobody was going to work. They were all, you know, in Jerusalem and traveling, and they were on holiday, right? And they were that became a national holiday, at least in terms of taking off from work. In a place in which they are accustomed to refrain from work, so shall they do. Okay, so again, we have two different customs. Some say that you shouldn't do work even until midday. Some say that it's fine to do work until midday. One who goes from a place in which they work to a place in which they do not do work, or from a place in which they do not do work to a place in which they do work, we place upon him the stringencies of the place from which he came and the stringencies of the place which he went to. Meaning, if I'm coming from a place where they don't do work, even though I find myself now in a place where people are working at least until midday, I can't adopt that. I can't say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I need to be strict upon myself. Right? It's not going to be very clear to anyone that I'm specifically making a point of refraining from work. Nobody knows me. Nobody knows what I'm doing behind closed doors. But also vice versa. Just because I come from a place in which they do permit work and labor, and that's the custom, and now I go to a place in which they don't do work, I can't, you know, set up shop and start hawking my wares on Erev Pesach if it's out of consonance with the accepted custom minhag of that particular locale. So to a certain extent, when in Rome. And one should not deviate because of discord. Va'al yishaneh adam mipnei hamachlokes. Person shouldn't deviate from this practice of adopting whatever is happening in that particular location because we don't like machlokes. As much as, again, it's sort of a badge of pride. Sort of a badge of honor, that we're able to argue and we can still get along, we got to make sure that we can still get along. It's when we start to not get along that becomes problematic. If you're in somebody else's community and they're doing something that you don't ordinarily do, adopt it for that Shabbos. Don't make a stink. Don't make a big deal. Do whatever they're doing, because you don't want to the ability to say that I can do so for a Shabbos says that there is veracity to what you're doing. If I need to say that absolutely not, I will not, I cannot, it becomes that it's not just a matter of my personal custom, but that I think what you're doing is wrong. And that's really the overarching concept here, that we embrace diversity because we genuinely believe that there are a multiplicity of approaches to serving God, not every one of which is exactly the same as its neighbor. So I'm able to appreciate the idea that Sfardim do a little bit differently from the Ashkenazim and that the Hasidim do a little bit differently from the Litvaks. Fine, as long as it's sort of within the purview of Orthodox Judaism. So the ability to say that becomes really, really paramount. When you find yourself in this sort of position, we say, just avoid machlokes, avoid broigis, avoid getting into an argument with somebody. Just toe the line for the time that you're there, and that's it. And you can take care of whatever you might need to behind closed doors. Lou, and then Camille, and then Marvin.
And the classic example of that is for those people who don't eat the brachos on Pesach, but davka eat the brachos on Achron Shel Pesach.
To show that it's
other people were
interesting,
doing for the first
that it's okay.
Days,
okay.
That they're not wrong.
Right, interesting. Right, right. Yeah, Camille.
So then, going back to the beginning, you shall not cut yourselves, really means not that we practice things differently, but that we shouldn't make a big deal about it.
You don't create, right, the notion of dividing into factions becomes mm-hmm. becomes very different from the notion that there might be, in general, some diversity along the spectrum of the Jewish people.
And does that go back to I mean, cutting yourself, it does damage.
We take it in both manners. Yeah, homiletically, you know, the idea that, I think that homiletically what we're pointing to is that we consider the Jewish people, we spoke about it yesterday, we consider the Jewish people to be one organic entity, right? So that we view cutting the body and creating a divide within the Jewish people as being similar. That's not to say that the body isn't divided into various components, various limbs, each one of which has a different function, various organs, each one of which has a different function. So, you know, Judah's the gallbladder and Zvulun is the right kidney and, you know, Menashe is the left kidney. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a different approach. It's a different function, all of which are important for creating this organism called Klal Yisrael. But when you start removing and cutting out and saying that everyone else is wrong and unimportant and it's not what they do is inappropriate, that is too far. Whether that applies only to the rabbinic authorities or also to the laymen who fan the flames, so that we have those two different approaches. But it seems like this is what these approaches are what we rely upon. Having said that, there is this additional notion of not wanting to create machlokas. We'll end with that in 1 second. Yeah, Marv.
Yeah, I've got two things to say, both on opposite sides. Mm-hmm. In the shul that I came from, the shul had a machlokas. We did not wear tefillin on Kol Hamoed.
Uh-huh.
But the guy who sat behind me, who came out of the Holocaust, who had come from Europe,
right?
He always wore tefillin. Nobody said anything. That was just his minhag, and we accepted that.
The most important minhag I think that we have is that you never, ever, 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 ever argue with a Holocaust survivor. That is the number one rule of incorporating such people into our community, because it's for a whole host of reasons.
And the second comment is that in the stories they talk about the Vilna Gaon, mm-hmm. there was a man who came to the Vilna Gaon and asked about a certain practice. And the Vilna Gaon said, that's not the practice that I do. Mm-hmm. And the man said, oh, I knew the chief rabbi of Vilna was wrong. And the Vilna Gaon replied to him, when I'm in Vilna, I will have to do differently than what I have been doing in the past.
Right, right. Yeah. Look, the greatest of authorities are also the most humble and appreciate these concepts more than anyone. Right? That's usually, not always, usually it's the layman who create these issues, right?
Yeah,
it's that you have the layman who